ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
How often do you think about death?
I think about death all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, like, no, all the time, and but also about loss.
And when your time comes, how do you think you'll look back at the life you've lived?
The things that you care about towards the end of your life are the feeling of sunshine on your skin, the taste of a peach, the hug of your child or the fur of your dog. Those are the elements, I think, of a plain life, perhaps also, that actually are the things that are important.
It's the only sure thing in life that we will all die someday. And look, if you missed the incredible Australian Story episode with the late longtime ABC radio host James Valentine, I cannot recommend it enough. It is about how James decided to die on his terms, to die well, you could say. And that's what we're exploring today on Big Ideas, perhaps the biggest idea of all, how to live and die well. Welcome to you. It's Natasha Mitchell bringing you this bittersweet, big-hearted conversation on Big Ideas today with a thinker on plain living and a scholar of dying. On stage at the Clunes Booktown Festival on Jajawarung country in central Victoria, Dr. Hannah Gould is a cultural anthropologist who specialises in death, religion, material culture in Australia and Northeast Asia. She's a senior lecturer and fellow with the Death Tech Research Team at the University of Melbourne. And she's authored several books, including her latest, How to Die in the 21st Century, A Whole New Way to Talk About Death. Dr. Antonia Pont is a yogi. She's Associate Professor of Writing and Literature at Deakin University. And her latest book is Plain Life on Thinking, Feeling and Deciding. And the host today has explored death in so many creative ways. She is co-founder of the spoken word art salon, Better Off Said, Eulogies for the Living and Dead. She hosts the podcast Marieke Hardy is Going to Die. And she's also a screenwriter and playwright with a forthcoming Melbourne Theatre Company play called Losing Face. Handing over now to the wonderful Marieke Hardy.
So it's interesting, and we've all acknowledged through group emails that these are very different books. One is about how to live a plain life in broader terms, and we will unpack it. And Hannah, yours is about how to have a good death. But I do think there's a link between them. There's many links between them. And one of them is that they're both invitational and they're both inviting us to ruminate on our lives and what is important. So before we really start unpacking life and death, I want to ask about the origins of your story to writing both of these books. And I'll start with you, Hannah, because I think Ray Martin had something to do with it.
Yes, he did. So I never really thought that I would end up devoting my at least academic professional life to studying death. But I was always interested in religion, and I've always been interested in, as an anthropologist, those things that are universal and those things that we do very differently. And apart from taxes, death is the only other one that we all kind of do around the world the same, and yet we all do in very distinct ways depending on our culture, depending on where we are in history. And, you know, I set myself off to grad school and I thought this would be a great thing to study, and then as happens with life, my dad died. And my dad died when I was 22 years old. And as I write in the book, I thought, well, I'm perfectly mature. It's the oldest I've ever been. Of course I can cope with this, fine. But it probably had much more of an extraordinary impact on my life and who I am than I was willing to acknowledge at the time. And so, you know, I say some people go to therapy and some people get PhDs. and I did both. I highly recommend the combo. I think there's a few in academia that could do with the therapy as well as the PhD. And so I slowly became kind of just a death studies person, the death scholar. And it's surprising, but there's very little actually researched and written about death in Australia. And so when one day Ray Martin and the BBC, you know, slid into my DMs pretty much and said, hey, we want to create a TV show about what it means to die. I said, oh, I have some thoughts about that. I have some ideas about what it should mean to look like to die in Australia, and been writing about it and thinking about it ever since.
Yeah, and become a bit of a go-to gal for people, because people, I think, are so keen to talk about it. And I do like in your book that you don't like referring to yourself as death positive, because as you say it, death is actually really f***ing hard. Sorry, there will be some cussing as
well.
I should have warned about that.
Don't worry, it's only life and death.
But you like to see it as more of a death neutral, because in your words, life is a cousin to death.
Yeah, death is f***ed. Like, I'm not positive about it. I hate the fact that we're all going to die, and I hate the fact that our loved ones will leave us. I don't think we have to go and celebrate it, or even that we necessarily have to have a funeral that looks like a celebration of life. Like, you can have a funeral where everyone's weeping and crying and really sad, because, hey, death is f***ed. But I do think we need to become, in the same way that we've become perhaps more from, we've shifted from body positive to body neutral, sex positive to sex neutral, perhaps there's a way we can kind of decouple morality a little bit from death, right? So we're becoming more death neutral. Death is something that happens, whether you like it or not, and you can prepare for it and you can learn to accept it, but you don't have to love the fact that it's going to happen to do those things.
Antonia, your book is a quite a philosophical rumination on what it is to live a plain life, which is a very broad term for, I guess, lots of subheadings within the book, which is about kindness and capacity and community. What led you to, on the yoga mat with your head in downward dog, I assume, starting to think about putting this on the page? And I guess, what did you learn when you were writing it?
Well, I started writing about a plain life in maybe like 2017. I sort of started trying to say something about it. And it was actually linked to the way that I felt around me that everybody was proclaiming to be anxious and to kind of label themselves as anxious. And because I'm also a poet, I'm very fussy about words. And I just wondered if we were doing ourselves a kind of, like we were calling ourselves names, you know, like I'm anxious, whatever, whatever. And I thought, yeah, but where is there good reason to be really frightened in this current moment? And where is some other stuff sort of on our shoulders where we've just been a bit shoddy, right? So there's a bit of us that's just a bit shoddy, and there's a bit of us that's also in a moment that is genuinely terrifying. And I felt like anxiety was this way to kind of depoliticize and both blame ourselves and not have enough structural critique. And I think, weirdly, the plain word comes from the feeling I get when I practice. So when I practice, you know, I tell my students, if you're in tree pose and you think you're great, you'll fall over. And if you're in tree pose and you think you're crap, you'll also fall over. You got to just don't think about yourself. Just do the pose and then you'll have good balance. And there's something about that thing of like, we either feel like we have to inflate ourselves constantly. We're in a culture that really encourages a lot of self-branding. I don't know what that is, but I'm resisting, but I should get on board, right? You know, but you know, we have to kind of be bigger than life, and at the same time we feel so bad about ourselves. And I think plainness is like trying to get the needle to just come center a bit, where we have dignity, you know, you like yourself enough, but you're not totally preoccupied with yourself all the time, because it's a suffering. To be self-preoccupied is such a suffering. And all the religious traditions just say, you want to feel better? Go and serve at a soup kitchen. Like, just stop thinking about yourself, which doesn't mean don't go to therapy and sort yourself out. So it's tricky, right?
It's such a fine balance too, isn't it? Because I guess the take home for what both of you are saying is take a moment and look at yourself, look at how you want to die, look at how you want to live, look at how you want to be buried. Do you think, Antonia, people see that term, a plain life, and their first assumption is that it's about austerity or shedding or living a monkish existence, which it's not at all.
No, it's not, and it's really tricky. I'm also an academic, even though I didn't put that in the bio, but you know, when I presented the book to some academic colleagues, and they sort of were like, oh, is this like going back to nature? And I'm like, no, oh gosh, no, because I really like living in the city, and I, you know, whatever, you know, it's not about that at all. I think it's really to do with one's relation to self and to selfishness, and a kind of wisdom around what helps us, I say in the book, what helps us not trash our own lives, like actively trash the life you have, which is precious and finite. It's finite and you get one, you know, well, that's debate about that, but let's say we get one and we'll leave the cosmology aside.
I do want to talk later about the things that we put in our mind's path to stop us from that mode of thinking. But maybe I'll start with talking about our fear of thinking about our own death. As main characters, which we all are, you think, well, everyone else is going to die, but not me, not this guy, not the main character. This is, you know, this the show ends. What is that fear, and how do you encourage those healthier discussions to think not just about mortality, but as you put so beautifully in the book, about how do you want to be buried? What do you want your funeral to look like? How do you want your death care to look like? How do you begin those conversations, and why are we so afraid of them?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, nobody wants to talk about death, but here you all are. And, you know, this idea that... Yeah. I'm just going to say, I have a, you know, blanket disclaimer that if anyone dies at any of my talks, that's
great branding. I don't understand.
Great branding. It's actually in the fine print that you donate your body to me and I get to do. this is kind of one of the weird things about death in contemporary Australia and contemporary society. It's like we're all terrified to think about it when it's about us, our body, our loved ones, our dog. You know, you couldn't possibly, that's my hard line, never think about dogs dying. But we're also all obsessed with death. Like, the mushroom tapes is like one of the big, you know, bestsellers. Everyone's listening to their true crime podcasts. Half of this festival is dedicated to gruesome true crimes. And so everyone kind of loves indulging in death when it is voyeuristic, when it's violent, when it's someone else. You know, Midsummer Murders. Beautiful, quaint English town, except someone's getting stabbed every weekend. And that's fun. That's the entire notion of a cozy mystery or a cozy murder. And so we have this kind of, I suppose, distaste, therefore we're bringing it towards ourselves and thinking about ourselves, because it does require us to kind of consciously reflect on the fact of finitude, that we are limited. Right? And then that brings into view all of these big questions, like if I was actively thinking about the finitude of my life, would have I done that career? Would I have married that person? Would I have cared so much about what I dress or what I wear or what other people think about me? And from every kind of survey that we've done and every kind of experience I've had with dying people, the answer is no, you wouldn't care. You don't care towards the end of your life. The things that you care about towards the end of your life are the feeling of sunshine on your skin, the taste of a peach, the hug of your child or the fur of your dog. Those are the elements, I think, of a plain life, perhaps also, that actually are the things that are important. So getting people to talk and think about death is actually getting them to talk and think about what they care about in life. And what I've found is that it's really an exercise of having to get them to kind of break the seal. No one wants to talk about death, but the moment I say that I'm a death studies scholar, all of a sudden it's like, okay, so I have 5 questions for you about my grandmother's funeral. No one's ever been able to answer me. What happens at the crematorium? Do I get the ashes back? You know, should I have a funeral? Should I go to my ex-boyfriend's mum's funeral? You know, how do I mourn my dog? People have lots and lots and lots of questions. We just have to find a way and find spaces to create a generous conversation.
Yeah, in your book you also, and I have actually done this, there's an app called WeCroak that you can download, and it reminds you on alerts 5 times a day that you're going to die. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's so good. It's so good.
It's a cute little frog, because all mortality messages should be delivered with some degree of whimsy. So it's a little frog that just pops up on your iPhone and says, hey, you're going to die.
And that's from, it's a philosophy in Bhutan where they say in order to live a good life, one must remind themselves of their own mortality and death 5 times a day.
Yeah, mortality salience is an extremely important teaching within Buddhism, right? This idea of the inherent impermanence of reality and the impermanence of oneself. That is a kind of requirement to a good life. It's integrating both life and death together. You can't live a good life without thinking about death.
And thinking about death is what author and anthropologist Dr. Hannah Gould does for her day job as senior lecturer and fellow with the Death Tech Research Team at the University of Melbourne. She's on Big Ideas today, ABC Radio National and ABC Listen's live event show with me, Natasha Mitchell. Hannah's new book is called How to Die in the 21st Century, A Whole New Way to Talk About Death, while Antonia Pont's latest is called Plain Life, on thinking, feeling and deciding. We're coming to you from the stage of the Clunes Booktown Festival in central Victoria with host Marieke Hardy.
Well, now we're on Buddhism. It's very interesting that both of you reference it very lightly in your books. Hannah, when we'll talk about a little bit more about funerals and different funerals, and you talk about a lot of modern funerals being Buddhist, that they kind of cherry pick from Buddhism. Antonia, it's really interesting in your book, sometimes you refer to Buddhists as us, and then you say you are not a card-carrying Buddhist.
She's such a good reader.
It's terrifying.
So what is it that you've taken from Buddhism that has helped you in kind of interrogating what it is to have a plain life?
Well, I was like a Catholic girl doing my rosary every day, which is a bit weird. Like, yeah, it doesn't make you friends in the playground, right? But in a way, it's like, you know, rosary, it's also like mantras. It's like a thing to put you in a state that changes your kind of everyday relation to what's happening and gives you another space, I think. Yeah, and I think, I mean, I've done a lot of Zen. Zen's been the backbone of my practice since I have an essay online you can find called Private Practice, and it's all about how I sort of found Zen. It was because my friend had the hots for a guy at the Zen group, right? And he was like, you know, brown and skinny and wore those bands on your wrists. Sorry if anyone's here is like that, yeah? So, you know, that's how Buddhism happened to come to my life. But it was also, I think, like, what are the three treasures, you know? Impermanence, and then no self, and then emptiness. And it's just philosophically sound. Like, I don't know. I really wouldn't say I was card-carrying Buddhist on the census at all. But I think impermanence is just correct. If you meditate long enough or contemplate or walk around the gardens thinking about it, impermanence is ontologically accurate. And so is no self in a way. You know, all the Zen stories say, you know, the teacher says, go off and find the self. And this poor student grapples and struggles and comes back 2 years later and says, I failed. And the teacher says, very good. Of course you fail, because once you go looking for that centre that would be somehow yours, you know, it's a little bit, it just, you don't find it objectively when you go searching. And then I think the emptiness thing is, like, I've had friends where they're like, oh, emptiness scares me. It sounds like a horrible screaming silence. And I'm like, what about vastness? And then they're like, oh, that's nicer, you know, the poetry of vastness or emptiness, that things are, they're so connected. It's like everything is so connected, it can't have anything of itself. You know, the bread isn't just the bread you ate this morning. It's the baker who got up at 2 a.m. to get the bread to you, you know, like, and it just keeps going down that track. I think Thich Nhat Hanh has beautiful meditations on that, you know, like, exactly, like, where does this come from?
So the great Zen Buddhist teacher, Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, late great Thich Nhat Hanh, has a teaching called The Cloud Never Dies, in response to a young children's question about, you know, I'm very sad that my dad has died, what do I do? And he looks at a glass of water. And the thing I love about this is it's both a Buddhist teaching but also scientifically accurate, which is to say that given the notion of the water cycle in our universe, you know, a cloud never dies, it will become the tea that I drink. And it sounds funny to say that I find a lot of comfort in thinking about that, but I actually really do when I contemplate death. And not to go too deep, icky to begin with, but we do, and when I teach death and dying at university, we do contemplations on decomposition. So I get all my students to think about corpse pose in yoga. Next time you're doing a shavasana.
The most advanced pose.
Yeah. Next time you're doing a shavasana on your yoga mat,
to think about the decomposition of their bodies and to think about all of the ways in which their body is just an amalgamation of matter, even their self, even your consciousness. It is just a temporary configuration that we happen to call I for convenience. And one day, all of the little buggies that live in your stomach and are decomposing your lunch right now for you, all that will happen in death is that they will take over. And your consciousness will give up, but they will take over your body and your body will become back to the earth as it always was. And some people think that's quite confronting and scaring. I think it's
one of the most beautiful chapters in the book, I think. It's really, really beautiful. You've done this job of breaking it down, quite literally breaking it down, breaking the body down, but describing what happens in, again, as such an invitational way. It does happen to all of us. Can I say a thing that I loved about both books is both of you being prepared to show vulnerability as writers. Hannah, I'm going to talk about your grief about your dad in a moment, and also in a broader sense what it is to grieve imperfectly or perfectly. But Antonia, as you ask all of us to look at our lives and how we access a plain life, it's amazing. It is such a broad term, but what is within it is so rich. There are questions you've also asked yourself. You revealed when you talk about kindness, you said sometimes you have to look at ways that you have not been kind in your past, and that often annoyingly for you comes up during meditation or being a yogi. What are the questions you think that people should start asking themselves, and how can they be kind to themselves when those difficult things come up?
That's a great question. I think that it really helps to give the body, the substrate or whatever, as much chance to be as robust as we can be in our various moments of life. So that's different for a 7-year-old, it's different for a 50-year-old and an 80-year-old. But I think if we do something to give our body robustness, which is already a kind of care, it's not boot camp, it's not discipline, it's not those yucky words, I don't like them, but something, you know, I know when I'm looking after myself or when I'm kind of, you know, borrowing, I call it borrowing on my future credit card. It's like, I'll just borrow from my future self, who'll apparently have more energy than my current self has. Well, that doesn't make any sense. And I'll just go into a spiral of debt and whatever. So if I'm a little bit robust, that's why I think when I'm doing yoga poses, I'm strong enough because I'm giving myself a little bit of energy, a bit of oomph to face things I've done. So then it's like, you know, you had a bad day, you had a weird feeling in your stomach, you know, you were just like, oh, I feel a bit uneasy. It's like, yeah, because you were horrible. At about 12:07, you had some passive-aggressive little jab at someone, even in your head, but maybe out loud. And so no wonder you're feeling crap for the rest of the day, because something in me is like playing there. And in the moment, it's too fast. And, you know, we always love to think everyone's doing it to us. And sometimes they are, and we have to identify when they're doing it to us. That's another level of accuracy, but sometimes it's me. And I find that joyous. Like, I find it's a little bit kind of zingy, but at the same time, then I'm free of myself. You know, then it's like, well, I can be aggressive too. I'm a little bit envious. I'm a little bit shoddy sometimes. And then I'm not kind of running around going, why is the world mean to me? You know, and I think that vagueness is what often we're in this place, it's not clear. So I think therapy definitely helped me to go, they did that to me, ouch, and I did that to her, or I did that to, you know, them. And it's just a bit cleaner or something.
It's interesting because both books circle around really, what do I want, what do I need? What do I want for my death? What do I want for my life? And it sounds on the surface an intrinsically selfish question, but ultimately it's not, because when you start to answer those needs, you have more capacity to give. And I do want to talk about capacity in a moment. But Hannah, if we talk about grief, and you very generously shared your grief about your father earlier, and you write about it very movingly in the book as well, but you have a whole chapter in there about people thinking that they're grieving wrong or imperfectly, if they weep, if they don't weep. What do you think you want to share with people about what's accessible with grief and what you've learned?
Firstly, you cannot do grief wrong. You absolutely cannot do grief wrong. You can't do it better. You can't fail at it. There's no particular form it should take. It shouldn't cut off after 3 months or a year or 10 years. If you still feel grief strongly after 25, 30, 40 years, fine, that's okay. We have, in attempting to
explain or educate about grief, we've accidentally fallen into this way of talking about it quite normatively, right? Like, here are the stages that you're supposed to go through. Here's the timeline that it's supposed to take. Here's how you're supposed to get through it. And this is kind of the fundamental underlying presumption here is really like inherited from Freud. And it's this kind of catharsis model. You have to feel sad, but you feel sad so that you can feel better. You've got to get through it. Grief is a thing you've got to get through so you can get to the other side, some sort of bizarre promised land where you feel normal. You don't. That's not what it is. And I can see people in this room, if you're a griever, if you've grieved before, you understand this. But if you haven't, then it can be incredibly lonely because a lot of people around you have forgotten that you're grieving or they've moved on. So after all the flowers have wilted, when you've eaten the final bloody casserole that people keep bringing you because they don't know how to express their emotions, so here's another lasagna for the family that's grieving. After all of that is gone, you're still grieving, but no one else wants to talk about it.
And in your book, you do, and with every chapter, which I love, there's a lot of, you know, I love a list, and it's lots of pragmatic things. And there's a really lovely moment on what to tell people, how to help someone who's grieving. Because when you were grieving your father, you had a friend come around and write your emails for you.
Yeah, all of my best friends, one of the best things I did is I couldn't get out of bed. But I knew that I wanted to still show up for work. So all of my best friends piled onto my bed and I handed over my laptop and they just answered my emails. And they wrote excuses and they wrote thank yous and they wrote f*** off, she's grieving. And they wrote everything for me, but it allowed me to still exist as a person, right? And I think there's all of these different ways, like we get so, so worried about not saying the right thing to somebody that's grieving. What do I say? How on earth can I turn up as a community? The worst thing that's ever happened has already happened to them. Don't worry, you're not gonna make it worse. You can't. It's so much more important that you just turn up, that you show up, as opposed to the exact words. And the other thing is I always say to people, when you find out that somebody has died, that you're grieving, go into your phone, go into your calendar and set a little alarm. And set an alarm for 3 months' time. And that is when you need to be a good friend. Because it's great to be a good friend in the first 10 days, the first couple of weeks, but in 3 months when everyone else has moved on, that's when you can show up for people. And that's the first thing you should do.
I really love that. And I also think we are very neatly segued onto the topic of friends, because we keep finding that balance between self-reflection and community. Like for you in that moment, being able to ask your friends for what you needed. But Antonia, you speak really beautifully about a friend that you met when you were much younger, who is only known as C, which is very mysterious in the book. But C gives you this, I think, wonderful piece of wisdom that everyone should pass. Maybe I should let you share it because it's so much about listening to the body and what feels good in the body. Can you share it with us?
Sure. So I was on exchange in Germany when I was 20, 21, and I met one friend there in the women's room of the university, because that was at the time. And because I'd been lonely before in foreign countries, and I'm like, you've got to show up somewhere. You've got to go somewhere where someone's likely to say hello, rather than just like mill about the open campus. So I met this woman there and assumed I was very boring because I couldn't string German words together in any way. But she was just really, she was very plain. Like, and I was looking for someone sort of effusive and kind of like, wow, you're so amazing. Don't we get along really well? But she was just really flat in her affect. It may be, but also in herself, there's something really steady about her. It's amazing. And so we became friends, and I describe it in the book, and she basically taught me this thing that I'm sure I've forgotten it in practice, but I've never forgotten it since then, which was like a little formula, which I want to attribute to her. But in the book, I realized that Spinoza, the famous 17th century philosopher, also kind of in some ways hinted at it. I don't know that she'd read Spinoza, but the Germans, they're widely read often. Yeah, probably. And so she just said, oh, look, with people, I try not to say what they're like, because
we all know that when we do that, we're on the edge of bitching, right? We're either on the edge of praising in a way that we don't understand or kind of running them down, and it doesn't do our dignity any good, right? We all do it, but, you know, and the Buddhists would say, stop it, and the yogis say, stop it. But she said, no, when I'm with someone, I just see afterwards how I feel. And if I feel energized and good about myself and excited for my next thing I'm doing and whatever, she's like, well, then probably they're good for me. But I don't need to say what they're like, essentially, because for someone else, they're good for them, you know, or bad for them or whatever. And I just was like, oh my gosh, this is so freeing, because I don't have to make a judgment about someone which is likely to be wrong, or even if it's right in that moment, 2 weeks later, they've already amended something in their behavior or they had a bad day. And so I've ended up saying something a bit nasty about someone that's not accurate. Whereas this thing of like, after I see this person 17 times, I always go home and I empty the fridge of all the cookies, ice cream, and then I kind of, you know, send off a few passive aggressive SMSs, and then I just, you know, feel like I can't do my job. It's like, if that regularly happens, maybe I don't even need to say something about that person. Maybe I just don't book to see them again. You know, or not so enthusiastically. And so I like this idea that rather than judging them or whatever, just to be like, for me, they're not my medicine. They're just not a good medicine for me. And it's simple,
and you apply that philosophy not just to people in your life, but also food and experiences and, again,
politics
and capacity about how you feel, like, you know, what food do I actually feel like, instead of judging myself for it. Or there's a lot of kind of anchoring back to need.
And we are anchoring back to need today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with these big thinkers in matters of life and death, Dr. Antonia Pont, Dr. Hannah Gould and host Marieke Hardy. Natasha Mitchell bringing you big ideas from the wonderful Clunes Booktown Festival on each year in central Victoria.
Within funerals, there's a lot of symbolism and ritual. Why is it been important to people, and what bits do you think are worth, well, I mean, this is too broad a question, what do you think is worth keeping? Because it's personal, isn't it, really, what we do with our funeral and how we celebrate it?
Yeah, what is worth keeping? So there's a bit of a story to tell about Australian funerals and like what you expect, because most people here, if you're going to the funeral of somebody and they're not particularly religious, like maybe it's going to be a Roman, you know, Catholic mass or... But if they're not particularly religious, then we all have this kind of formula for what we now expect at a funeral. Like, you're going to go in, there's going to be some pop music, there's going to be a slide with photos, and that's your moment to cry, right? And then there'll be speeches, and then there'll be more music, you'll feel a bit happier, go outside, have a party pie, have a bit of a sandwich, cup of tea. You know, this is what the contemporary Australian funeral is, but that is the kind of celebration of life formula that's actually quite contemporary, and actually it really very much derives from Australia. We invented this funeral in the 70s or 80s, and it comes through the secularisation of our wedding celebrancy and Lionel Murphy, the great reformer who Bob Brown was talking about in his book the other day, and him kind of deciding that we should have secular celebrants in Australia, that we shouldn't have our rituals, our most important rites of passage in Australia, we shouldn't have them just restricted to religious people, it should be us, lay people, lay folk, that can also do these rituals for each other. Which was a great intervention for him, but basically meant that we had to reinvent what a funeral looks like, right? What is important. And so for a lot of us, people have kind of been searching around for how to do a funeral, right? How to make it meaningful, what words to say, what poems to read. Many people will turn to religious texts, even if they're not particularly religious, right? Reciting the Lord's Prayer or reciting a Buddhist teaching, even if they're not Buddhist, very commonly. Lighting candles, right? Offering flowers. Just little things that you try to do to hang your emotion onto a ritual, right? For an anthropologist, all a ritual is a repeated activity. Making your coffee every morning is a ritual. So if we can find ritual acts in the funeral ceremony that allow us to kind of create meaning, then that's how we have to kind of create this farewell together collectively. And there's really no limits on what you can do, yeah, as you would know.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that as well, because I guess that the symbolism is important, but sometimes people see a funeral, there's that terrible word closure. It's like, if I don't have the funeral will give me closure. And again, that speaks to a judgment on grief.
Why do we all want closure? Closure's boring. Closure's a lie. Closure's a lie. Closure's boring. A funeral's not going to fix your grief.
Let's talk about Last Hurrah Funerals, who are a Melbourne-based funeral service who I want to do my funeral. They are amazing.
Yeah, they're doing my mum's funeral, my funeral. Yeah,
they're booked up, but, you know, try and get in. Do you want to share some of the more fabulous, accessible funerals that they've done there? They do great work.
This is what I want to say. You can do anything you want for your funeral. You don't have to have it in a town hall or a religious, you know, organisation. You can have it at the pub. You can have it with friends at the beach. If you want a medieval reenactment funeral, they have done that. If you want your coffin at the Tote music venue surrounded by, you know, a mosh pit while a heavy metal music band plays, they have done that. Okay, if you want to cause an absolute fuss and have, you know, streamers and confetti and stop all of the traffic on Sydney Road, they've done that. You know, if you're a footy fan and you want your mates to carry your coffin through the goalposts so that you can kick one last goal, they have done that. And this is, all of it shows that the most important thing for us today when we think about contemporary funerals is that the funeral authentically reflects the values of the deceased.
Someone that you want that, because they're not going to know. That's the thing. Write it down or tell someone.
Funeral dreams are great. Funeral conversations are even better. It doesn't have to be big. It can be a post-it note. It can be an Instagram. You can like a funeral home. You can order the food and the drink and the songs right now. But you have to have the conversation.
I guess when we talk about the awkwardness in those conversations or the reluctance to have those conversations, we're speaking quite specifically about a Western culture where there's cultural accessibility to death rituals and grief. You speak quite beautifully about this, the Japanese ritual of, is it 1 month, 3 months, a year? Can you talk us through that?
So within a lot of Buddhist traditions, but also traditions that have structures of ancestor veneration, death is not a moment, it's a process, right? The dying of the person is not instantaneous. It is a slow movement of them away from the world of the living and into the world of the dead, whatever that destination may be. That destination for you might be nature. That destination for you might be reincarnation. That destination might be heaven, whatever it is. And there are a lot of religious and cultural traditions around the world that set up this ritual structure. Yes, you have the funeral, but then 49 days later, you might have a ceremony that marks the kind of disconnection of the soul from this worldly realm. And then you might have a ceremony at 3 months, and then at 6 months, and then a year, and then 5 years. And you slowly, slowly, slowly increase that distance. So you give yourself a little bit more time to bring the dead back into your life. And I just think it's lovely to think of, you know, a funeral shouldn't be a single event. This is not one or done, because in the same way as not showing up for community, that doesn't give your community, your village, opportunities to look after you, right? And you want to give people invitations to come and support you, not just on the day of the funeral of the week, but in 3 months, in 6 months, in a year. You know, have a funeral party, have a birthday party for the person that died. Find ways to create little rituals that bring the dead back into your life through time.
And Tanya, I do want to talk to you about, you know, we were talking about having a funeral dream in your head and needing to articulate it. A lot of what you have in your book is about internal temp checking at a lot of different times. How do you find the balance between the internal reflection and actually living in the moment? And I guess this is a two-part question, because how does, you know, the reminders that I get about my mortality 5 times a day, how does acknowledging one's mortality fit into that plain living?
Yeah, I was laughing, and we had some emails, and you know, when you said you downloaded the app and reading your book, Hannah, I think about death all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, like, no, all the time. And but also about loss. Like, I think I was sort of like an MC at a friend's kind of casual wedding, and I probably wasn't what they imagined, but I was like, okay, let's mourn the loss of the lives you're about to leave behind.
Love it.
You know, but I'm like, look, no more sexy sleepovers, right? They were fun, and that's, they're done now because you're married.
I mean, they asked you, so they should have known what you were getting.
That's right. I remember having a yoga teacher when I was much younger, and she was like, she was Japanese, and she would say, you know, every night you die and are born in the morning, and that somehow sleeping is a sort of accepting of death because you don't know you're going to wake up. And I took that on in that sense of like, we're losing all the time. And that's like one of the key factors of good psychoanalysis or good therapy is like, if you think you can insure your life against loss, you open your life to the worst. And we live in a moment that promises us that there'll be no loss. You know, we won't get wrinkles, we won't change here, no one ever needs to go away, just stalk people, they never leave you. Whatever, whatever, like no one will, there'll be no loss in your life and capitalism will protect you from it. And even though while it terrifies you that you won't even have a minimal life, like it's like this double message, right? You'll have everything and there'll be no dissatisfaction to plague your human existence. And by the way, probably you'll never have a house, a job, a partner or, you know, whatever. So we live in this split system that I think is making us a bit wild, yeah.
Well, no, I just want to say when I hear you talking and kind of all the joy in your voice about this plain life is that I think there's a kind of idea that us morbid folks who think about us deathlings that think about death all the time, like this is very sad or depressing or dark. Death people are hilarious. Like I've never heard more humour, more joy, more in the moment, like just frivolity than from the guys that work at the crematorium. I mean, like, and I think there's really something to be said about the kind of freedom that that brings, but also just the pure joy that that brings to be able to, the mudita in Sanskrit, in Buddhism, the sympathetic joy, right? To be able to see my dog or another human being like having a moment of happiness. And it's more of an appreciation for it because I know that we're going to die.
A friend of mine is started doing this practice because he and his partner would read a story to their child every night before bed. And then one night she said, I don't need you to do that anymore. And he said, I didn't realise last night was the last time. So he says he has a last time philosophy every time he does anything, because at some point it is going to be the last time. It's going to be your last apple, your last kiss, your last pat of the dog. Yeah, all that sort of stuff. I think it's really, and it does sound morbid, but I don't think I've ever lived more fully or joyously than when I remind myself that this experience is finite, shared and finite. And speaking of sharing, yes, you've got one at the back. We've got a microphone here, so if you can just use that. Thank you.
Hi. I think we had a lot of information about the death industry, you know, with funeral parlours and so on. But I wonder if you would like to comment on death doulas and death cafes that are happening.
My favourite ever interpretation of death doulas, I will get to death doulas, is that death doulas are the eldest daughters of the world. Is anyone here an eldest daughter? Yeah, I see you. I see you looking after your elderly parents and also your children. I see you remembering the doctor's appointments and the medications and finding out aged care homes. Yeah, ooh, yeah, ooh. So in the same way that we have birth doulas, right, there's an emerging movement to have death doulas, right? And this can either be an occupation or it can be an unpaid calling. People in the community that you can call on who know about death. And I think it's in some ways I think it is a really interesting kind of, you know, the analogy to eldest daughters is pretty strong, right? These are often unpaid labour, unfortunately, and it's women's labour in caring for ageing bodies and caring for dying bodies in our community. So it's in a new and emerging role that people are now taking on to look after the death. And in the same way, this goes alongside the kind of death cafe movement, creating spaces where you can have a conversation about death because perhaps you don't usually get a chance. And luckily now all of you have come to this talk, you can go out and be the kind of deafy people in your community as well. Just, you know, when you're having a nice coffee with somebody next week, you could just turn to them and say, what would be your funeral song? You know, and that's a fun thing that you can just introduce into conversation.
I think it's a great question as well, and thank you for it, because we've talked about what it is to live a good life and what it is to have a good funeral, but a big part of Hannah's book as well is how to have a good death, because so much of us gloss over that part. We say, I don't want to die in my sleep, no pain. Die in my sleep, no pain. Family's around me, they all love me. You know, that kind of thing. But I
90,
think...
90. Just finished your great work of your life. Complete, tick. It's published. You go
people
to sleep.
Weeping in the streets.
Yeah. They stop the bells. Everyone wears black. That's the, good death.
But I think it is worth it because it's about what do you want for your pain management? Where do you want to be? There's a strain on the aged care industry. There's a strain on the, cemeteries. So I think they're all practical things to think about. So thank you for asking that question. Does anyone else have one? We've got one right down the front here.
Hello. You talked about the sleeping and how every night you go to sleep, it's like you realise you're going to die. And I work with children, and when that realisation of the dark and the black and the death and they're having trouble sleeping, how do you talk to them about this? Because I had one recently and it was like related to God and like just better conversations so they're not terrified.
I don't know how early one introduces the death guarantee with children. It's a really, I'm sure someone in the room is more qualified on this. I always think it helps me, it never helps me if someone says, don't be afraid, you don't have anything to be afraid of. Why are you sad? Don't be sad, things are going so well for you. Like all of this kind of advice we give each other, it never works for me. So I think the idea that you might say to a child, look, when we're human, we have a lot of times when we're afraid, and that is really normal, but it's not the only thing we feel, and often we even feel fear and excitement at once, or fear and sadness at once, or and so in a weird way to kind of include the difficult feeling rather than, because I think a lot of us put feelings in two baskets, one we're allowed to have and the other we should get rid of. But also, of course, feelings all come in strange like cake recipes where you're like, I don't even know what to call this cake of feelings. It doesn't, I haven't eaten it before.
I think all children should grow radishes and all children should have a guinea pig. Radishes and guinea pigs. Or insert
guinea pigs die quickly.
Short-lived. I really think gardening at both the end of your life and the start of your life, just always garden, just actually gardening throughout your entire life. It is impossible to be a gardener without coming to know something of death. Peter Kundal, who's my favourite, is close, I think I write in the book, as close as we have to a saint in my family. His practice of gardening was so much about death because he knew he would one day become compost. And I think early experiences of the cycle of life can be really helpful for kids about growing a radish. Only takes 6 weeks and then the radish dies or you eat it. Getting a guinea pig, they seemingly want to drop dead at all points of life. The least robust of the pets is a good way to introduce children to death. But I would also say, if possible, I think this is what you're getting at, is to be in the discomfort with them, to get into the trenches with them. I mean, for me, always my yoga practice is always a learning to sit with discomfort. And death is discomfort. And kids are often pretty good at it. I don't think we give them enough credit. In fact, sometimes kids are way better at death than we are. And we just feel really discomfort about how good they are.
I think we had another question down the front here. I'm so sorry. Also, I do agree that pets are such an accessible way for kids to understand death. And I just want to share this because Hannah talks about it in her book. The ashes of my old dog is in the ink of that tattoo. So my old dog is with me at all times, because you talk about symbolism and what we do with ashes. You can mix it with tattoo ink, I'm just saying. Can we have a question down the front here?
I was just wondering what you thought about how we approach death when it's accidental, sudden, tragic. You know, there's preparing for your death, but then there's the ones that we cannot prepare for. And if that changes how we approach it and the rituals and things that go along with it.
We are all so bloody lucky that we get to sit in this room and try and convince ourselves to think about possibly preparing for death. It is an incredible privilege to be in Australia and to have access to the healthcare systems that we have, the welfare systems that we have. If you are born in Australia today, you have an average life expectancy of 82. If you are not an Indigenous person, if you are not a member of a disadvantaged, discriminated group, if you are not the victim of a capitalist system that means that some people die before others, it is an incredible privilege that we get to plan for and think about and dream of a good death, because a bloody hell of a heap of people don't. And they are forced towards death and they are forced towards grief more than anyone else. I have a mate, young Indigenous woman. She has been to more funerals than she has been to 40th birthday parties in her community. So as much as I'm saying a lovely, gentle, have a think about death, you should think about death because you get to. You get to age. What a privilege that is.
But also, I just want to yes and your question because I thought it was really beautiful. If someone in our community, and we have had the chance to think about it, is taken from us in a way that is tragic and sudden and painful, how does that change our access to these kind of symbolism and rituals and all that kind of thing? How do we process that?
It's not always appropriate. Like, I've worked with funeral celebrants who have said, you know, there are some funerals that you conduct where everyone's quite happy. You know, my 96-year-old grandmother, pretty fun funeral, frankly. You know, we all had party pies and a bit of a sing and a dance, right? But there are some funerals where your emotional trajectory of the community that is gathered, you're not getting happier, right? You're just getting through. You're just getting by. And I think it requires of us to expand our emotional resources and empathy in ways that we perhaps haven't practiced before. And you've seen that in recent years with the expansion of grief and community to situations like stillbirth and miscarriage and violent deaths and deaths by suicide. And those are the deaths that test us, test our capacity to show up for others in a really important way.
I've probably got time for one more question if anyone has one. I'm just down the front here. Thank you.
I'm not a fan of funerals, and I restrict my attendance to very close friends or families. Fortunately, I haven't had to go to many in my life. The last one I went to, I caught COVID. But my question really is, am I okay or am I being a princess?
Thank you. What an interesting question. Well, you're great. This is not how we self-talk in this room. Thank you.
This is an ongoing argument that we're stepping into. This is an adjudication of an ongoing...
I mean, I always think you should do what you want and take the consequences. In a way, I mean, if you don't want to go, you don't want to go. Maybe you also are someone who practices other forms of support. I mean, maybe you're not at the funeral, but 3 months later you invite them to the pub, and that could be quite meaningful because everyone else said, I did the funeral, tick, you know, and I've done my duty. So I'm a fan of doing what you want, but not assuming you get the pat on the back for it, but you're like, this is what I can do. And maybe it's too upsetting or it reduces your capacity so much, especially when you get COVID at a funeral, but it reduces your capacity so much. I don't know, what do you...
Show up for death and grieving however feels meaningful to you. You know, people ask me all the time, should I go to the funeral? In general, if it's a public invite, I always say yes, because most of the time it's people who would like to go but feel uncomfortable going. But if you don't feel like you have the capacity, then exactly what you said, show up in some other way, right? Make a donation, send flowers, send food, invite them to the pub. As I said, death is a process, grief is a process. It's not a single event.
I have a very dear friend in her 70s, and I've grilled her a lot about ageing and bodies and death and losing friends and all that. We talk about other stuff as well. No, she loves talking about death.
Fun conversation for her. Okay,
but she said to me, and I love having her in my life, and she said, there's one thing that I wish that I knew when I was younger. It's that I didn't have to do the things that I didn't want to do. She said, I spent so much time going to events that I thought, oh, I have to go into that, or someone's going to get mad at me. And she said, and now death is approaching, and I do what I want. And I think that goes, if I'm lucky enough to get to Andrea's age, then I hope I get, but it was helpful for me to hear in order to make those choices. we have to wind up. I'm so sorry. I do want to say, how do we have a good life and death? But I think, Antonia, I guess, what is it you've learned about really kind of sifting through what it is to have a plain life, a good life, a kind life? What is one thing that you've learned that you think is the simplest takeaway that someone could take from here without feeling overwhelmed that they don't want to do yoga or meditate? That feels a bit, no, but it might feel a bit inaccessible. What's something that you think people should start to perhaps think about that might give them that access to thinking about their own life?
It's good to really be on the lookout for kinds of talk and kinds of thinking that we just let slide into our DMs or, you know, slide into our... We just participate in it, and it really undignifies us. There's ways we speak of ourselves that I just don't think are dignifying, and why do we do it? And, you know, we've been trying to educate women for a long time, you know, don't say that about yourself. Don't speak about yourself in that way, or other groups who are more disadvantaged. It's like there's ways that we do...
Hello! Excuse me. Hello. Speaking about what it is to be
alive.
For
those listening at home, a dog has entered the building.
Oh, all right.
Now, breaking the spell, at this point, a random dog ran into the Clunes Town Hall, causing much delight.
We've got, okay.
And like true professionals, the conversation continued.
And Hannah, I know you don't have your mic because your hand is full of dog, which is what a lovely way to be. You have written this book, you've experienced death, you teach death, you speak death. How do you want to die, and what's your funeral song?
When I can no longer taste some really good red wine or a really stinky blue cheese, when I can no longer hold my dog in my arms, or walk outside in the grass, my bare feet, then I think I'm done. Yeah. And my body will be donated to the humanities. The sciences have enough bodies. The humanities are weird. I want them to do something funky with it. And I will be cremated. Shane will cremate me. I know the man who will cremate me. I think everyone should. And I'll be done. And it'll be a plain life, but a good one.
That's so wonderful. And the song.
At the moment. It is a song by The Beths, which is a Kiwi band. And the song is called Expert in a Dying Field.
Oh, there we go. Expert in a Dying Field.
Expert in a Dying Field.
I think
seems
that's
appropriate.
Great. Seconding Hannah, it is a privilege to sit in this room and think about our own mortality and our own grief, people we've loved, people we've lost, how we might want to go if we get the chance to choose, how we show up for people around us while we still have the opportunity to, but also just what a privilege it is to be in a room with other book lovers talking about words and ideas. So thank you to this beautiful festival. Again, thank you so much for being here, and see you on the other side.
With that life and death affirming conversation, Dr. Hannah Gould, Senior Lecturer and Fellow with the Death Tech Research Team at the University of Melbourne, author of How to Die in the 21st Century, A Whole New Way to Talk About Death. Dr. Antonia Pont is a yoga teacher, creative writing teacher, and author of Plain Life on Thinking, Feeling and Deciding. The host was Marieke Hardy. Catch her new play, Losing Face, this June through the Melbourne Theatre Company. Catch her wonderful podcast, Marieke Hardy is Going to Die, and her event series, Better Off Said, Eulogies for the Living and Dead. Big thanks to the whole crew at the Clunes Booktown Festival. And of course, part of living a good life is listening to ABC Radio National, which is where you'll find me with Big Ideas Mondays to Thursdays, 8 p.m, again the next day at midday, or of course anytime on the ABC Listen app or as a podcast. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.